Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to hit play on your iPod or on your computer or burn it to a disk or however you want to do it. Today, we're going to do our third top 10 show looking back on 2010 with Ron Hedges, who's done shows with me at ESI Bytes right from the beginning, including top 10 look back year and review shows in 2008 and 2009. Ron Hedges is a five-time presenter on ESI Bytes. He trails Judge Grimm by one show. He's also served as a United States Magistrate Judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007. Is a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board and participates in Sedona working groups on e-discovery and records, international e-discovery, and confidential public access issues. Ron is also a member of the advisory boards of the Advanced e-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. And among many other publications, he's also the author of Discovery of Electronically Stored Information, Surveying the Legal Landscape, and a co-author of Managing Discovery of Electronic Information, A Pocket Guide for Judges. So, Ron, glad to have you on show number five here.
And it's nice to be back, Ron.
Yeah, let's start off, first of all, with a synopsis of a few events. These aren't cases or publications, which you found significant in 2010 as an added bonus to the 10 cases we'll talk about. And the first event's the Duke Conference, and I'm glad you're mentioning it because I wanted to do an ESI Bytes show on this and asked Tom Ullman to do it a little too late. But so share a brief synopsis of the event and why it's potentially significant.
The Duke Conference was put together at the behest of Judicial Conference of the United States, which really is the rulemaking body under the Rules Enabling Act. And the purpose of the Duke Conference was to bring a lot of different people together to talk about a number of subjects. The subjects included pleading standards after Twombly and Iqbal, use of experts, the so-called vanishing trial, and e-discovery. So over the course of 2 days or so, there were a number of topics discussed. And I have it down as an e-discovery event because one of the matters that was really talked about was the need, or let's say the perceived need probably, for some type of uniformity in preservation and spoliation sanctions across the courts. Now, I know we're going to be talking about the subject later when we talk about pension committee and the like, Carl, but what's happened is the Judicial Conference, as a result of the Duke Conference, has started us down the road to at least look into the possibility of some type of change to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to address this question of uniformity. There was one committee meeting in November, I believe, and there'll be more on the horizon, but it'll be a few years before a proposed rule comes out and is adopted if anything happens. It comes out of it.
Yeah, you know, I'll put a quick plug in for this Friends of eDiscovery organization, informal organization that I have a chapter I work with in Pittsburgh. But I know that a couple of the chapters in the Midwest have had discussions on that exact point among lawyers and judges and corporations in sort of the Midwest to give their reaction to that exact issue. And I think it came out of the Duke Conference as sort of an informal fact finding, some Midwest common sense, you know, if we have that, you know, the ability to share what our thoughts are. So it's a really neat issue, and I certainly would put it on a top 10 list for this year. So
it's a great issue, and it raises a number of questions. For example, whether the federal rules really are the vehicle to address the question of uniformity. What are you going to do when, for example, you've got diversity cases? The general answer is, you know, the federal rules are procedural rules, the federal rules control, but I'm not that sure constitutionally or statutorily where this is going to go. But as I said, you know, it's the beginning of a long process, and I know a lot of people were talking about some type of uniformity.
Yep, yep. So, well, the second event you mentioned was our good friends up at the Sedona Conference. They're the Sedona Conference commentary on proportionality in e-discovery. And why do you think this was significant?
We speak a lot about e-discovery and about the costs and burdens of e-discovery. And I think often in the discussion, we don't spend time talking about proportionality. Proportionality underlies all of the federal rules of civil procedure. Rule 26B2C, in essence, says that all discovery has to be proportionate to the needs of the litigation or the nature of the litigation and the like. Rule 26B2C really does not spell out what you should be looking at, although there are advisory committee notes on point, there's case law on point. And what Sedona did was look at the concept of proportionality, break it down into things to talk about and think about that the rules and the advisory committee notes mention, and put together in one coherent package something that judges and litigants can look at when a proportionality argument is being made. I'll give you a perfect example. There's a decision that just came out within the last few weeks where a defendant was being asked to produce terabytes of information, which is a lot of information. And the judge said, you know what, we're going to go have you meet and confer with each other and talk about it, see what you can do to try to limit the discovery, but there's a lot of stuff here. And maybe we don't need all of it in the litigation. So I think that's something to think about. And I can give you and everyone who's going to listen into this the citation to the case. It's McNulty, McNulty versus Reddy, REDDY, Ice Holdings, 2011 Westlaw 116892. It's out of the Eastern District of Michigan on January 13th. And I really think you need to look at the decision in context of proportionality and in the context of the obligation to meet and confer, which is also underlying all the federal rules of civil procedure.
It's nice, Ron, how you now throw your teaser in for your 2011 list in the prior year show. Last year you did it with Quan.
Well, we're going to talk about something the Supreme Court decided yesterday, and that's not in 2010, but on the other hand, it informs what we're talking about. So I would commend the commentary on proportionality, other than the fact that I was on the drafting team for it.
Okay.
And tell attorneys when you're in court or you're going to go to court and you're either asking for information or resisting it, proportionality is something that really should be discussed. And you know, from my years on the bench and even after, proportionality often is overlooked, and I don't know why, probably because it's not something we as lawyers think of that much.
Yep, no, that's true. Everyone doesn't want to sing kumbaya if they're a litigator. It's hard.
Well,
when I've taught proportionality, I hand out the lyrics of kumbaya to start the session, and I say, it's not this. This is what you're all thinking, and it's not this. It's common sense. Fight your fight in the case. Not in discovery, but anyway. Well, let's look at some cases. Now, I know these aren't in order of importance, but they each deal with important concepts. So let's start with the concept of cooperation, which is a good lead-in from what we've just been talking about, and the Cartel Asset Management v. Ocwen Financial Corp., 2010 Westlaw 502721, District Colorado, February 8th, 2010. Why is this case important?
Well, it's not important per se because of the decision. It's important because it recognizes that attorneys have obligations to talk to each other and to cooperate with each other under the federal rules. And if you don't do it, a court can simply decline to entertain a dispute, which is exactly what happened in Capital Cartel. It was decided by Magistrate Judge Craig Schaefer from Denver. Parties came in on various applications, and in essence, what Judge Schaefer said is, you know what, neither one of you have really conferred about this, you haven't talked about it, there is an obligation running through the federal rules to cooperate, and to confer, which is to me the same thing. And until you do all these things, I'm not going to entertain your issues or your problems.
Okay, good. That's certainly important. The next concept we hear a lot about in presentations on eDiscovery, which is social media. And you have a few cases that you wanted to mention. Actually, if you want to start listing the cases and when you want to talk about, because you've got like three or four that you have identified here, why don't we do that? So,
well, there are a number of decisions here involving discovery of social media. EEOC was an action brought by EEOC on behalf of employees. The defendant was interested in looking to see what was posted on Facebook or the like by the employees. Romano versus Steele case is a decision that came out of New York that basically said this information is discoverable like anything else is, and you parties, if it's relevant, you need to produce it. And McMillan versus Hummingbird basically talked about the same thing. We have the McCann decision in here because McCann says, you know what? Social media is discoverable. If you decide to post things on Facebook or the like that's relevant to litigation or falls within the scope of what's discoverable under Rule 26b-1, a party can be required to produce the information. But the last decision we have in here comes from New York, the appellate division, not that long ago, and says, you know, there are limits to getting things on social media, like there are limits to all discovery. And you as a party just can't go to the adversary and say, hey, I want access to your Facebook page or whatever, so I can rummage through it and see what's on it. So these decisions really all say, number one, there is a reason to have discovery of social media because it may contain information that's relevant or reasonably calculated. But number two, just because someone may have a Facebook page or the like, it doesn't mean an adversary gets to rummage through it to see content. I think we're going to be seeing more and more use of social media in litigation. All the statistics coming out show that more and more individuals are using social media. I know there was a report that came out a few days ago about the number of people who have now signed up, for example, for Facebook. I don't know if the number is 500 million or whatever it is, but it's a big number of people. And if you and I are involved in litigation and you're technologically savvy, I would assume you would go to me, and if it's relevant, say, you know, I want information from your client that's on social media on issue X. So it's here to stay. We're going to see requests for discovery on this, I think, more and more often. And the issue is going to be a balancing test that a court's always had about whether information is discoverable or about whether it's the so-called fishing expedition I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, we did a ESI Bites last year, and one of the panelists talked about a lawyer trying to friend an adversary to learn
yes.
information. And I guess there's certain ethical lines that we're going to have to figure out. That one clearly seems to cross the line.
There's an ethical opinion that came out of, I believe, if it's not New York State, it's New York City, late last year that said it is unethical to basically commit some type of subterfuge to get access to an adversary's account. You can't be free. You can't have someone befriend an adversary so you can go in and see what the adversary's there and hand it to the others, to the attorney. The attorney couldn't do that himself. You certainly can't do it through some subterfuge.
Okay.
And we're seeing along the lines of that, by the way. We obviously are seeing these are competence and ethics issues about lawyers wanting to store information or export information to the cloud, lawyers making use of Facebook, what they can and can't say as far as advertising go and the like. We're going to be moving more and more into this technology in the next few years for no other reason that there are enormous economies. For example, if you're not having a server in your office or whatever, and using some third party to do all that for you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in search and retrieval, and I'm probably going to do a show on this at some point, but the cloud-based issue, there are a number of providers now that are offering shared server opportunities with search and retrieval tools at a really, you know, a very low price. And, you know, the show that I'll probably do is contrasting, you know, first of all, are you aware that the person selling you this isn't controlling your data, they're sending it somewhere else. Do all of us know where that's going? But secondly, cloud is a nice thing, but does it always lead to efficiency, especially if you don't have analytics built into these tools? You still got to do all the manual review. It's the clouds. Everyone throws the cloud into things, and at that point, it gets your attention. But sometimes you just got to think practically. What advantages are you getting out of the cloud, and what issues are you creating? So.
Well, ARMA, which I'm a member of, has published a book about cloud computing and the like, and I was a contributor to it, and it's addressing a number of issues about the cloud. Now, it's certainly not directed towards ethical issues involving lawyers. It's more business-oriented, but I think we're going to be seeing a lot more about this as we go forward, Carl.
Okay. Well, the next case deals with non-party e-discovery, and it's Crispin v. Christian Audigier, Inc., 2010 Westlaw 2293238 from the Central District, California, May 26, 2010. What's important here?
What's important here is distorted communication. And you and I are accustomed to just serving subpoenas on third parties to get information that third party may have that's relevant to a claim or defense in a lawsuit. The Stored Communications Act was enacted, well, I guess, almost over 15 years ago now to try to address discovery of electronic information from third parties. And that's basically what it's about. It has definitions of certain kinds of providers, and one of the things it says is that you, party, cannot compel the provider to turn over the content, for example, of email. And there are questions about storage and how long email has to be in storage and the like for third parties, but it's a very cumbersome procedure. And for those of you on the podcast who are following legislative developments, there has been a big move afoot in the last, well, I don't even know if it's been a year, maybe a year, to go back and revisit this entire statutory framework because statutes just have not kept up with the technology. So this Crispin is in here to talk about the Stored Communications Act, to alert readers to the fact that there are definitions under the Act that are relevant, and just for the fact that an internet service provider may be able to respond to a subpoena by saying, I am forbidden by the Stored Communications Act to give you content. So maybe you could turn over header information or the like. So maybe that's what's relevant, but most of the time I would think a party is interested in getting content of email and the like that may be stored by someone. And there are ways to get the information. A court, for example, can compel a party to give to tell the ISP to release content and the like, but that's pretty cumbersome.
Yeah, it's cumbersome, and they don't store that for long periods of time, or if you're looking at, like, instant messages and things like that. But anyway, you can oftentimes get information off devices and things like that. I mean, there are ways to, you know, if you have the device that sent the text, you can look at that. But anyway, yeah, no, that's definitely going to be a hot area of development. There's more information.
Well, whatever gets done in Congress for the next 2 years, but that's another issue.
Once we're done with healthcare. The next case deals with my professional area of interest in using technology for automated search and retrieval, although I'm not sure I love the case. It's the Mount Holly case, Mount Holly Inc., company v. Fellman Prod, Inc., 2010, Westlaw 1990555, Southern District, West Virginia, May 18th. And I won't read the entire site. That's probably enough. But what's important here?
What's important here is courts are groping with the question of what is reasonable when a party has done some type of automated search, and when production is made, some privileged information is inadvertently turned over. This implicates Rule 502B of the Federal Rules of Evidence, which basically says, you know, if you've made an inadvertent production, you need to show you, number one, it was inadvertent, number two, you took reasonable steps to avoid it, and number three, you took reasonable steps to tell the other side to give it back. That's basically what the rule says. And Mount Holly set the bar, I think a lot of people believe, a little too high. There were a relatively small number of documents that were inadvertently produced. There was a record that showed attempts were being made by counsel and by a vendor to take reasonable steps in the review to avoid any kind of inadvertent production. And the problem is, well, 502B really does not define what reasonable is, and the courts are going back to existing case law, pre-existing case law, to define reasonableness. And I think it's fair to say, Carl, just as I mentioned before, that there are varying standards for sanctions across the country or preservation. There's also varying standards for what reasonable means. It is a big issue. I guess the question at the end of the day is there ever going to be any uniformity in this? And I expect the answer is no, because this is not the kind of question that the United States Supreme Court is going to be taking cert on. So we've got the question of what's good enough, what's reasonable, how many documents do you get to turn over by mistake before you're called on the carpet for it or you're found to have committed some type of waiver? And then if there is a waiver, then the next question, of course, is what's the scope of the waiver? And that's also governed by Rule 502B. So Mount Holly is just an example of, let's say, the extreme end of a reasonableness calculation made by the court.
Yeah, I mean, one of the concerns in the industry and the technology side was this was a shot against technology. But my understanding of the case was there wasn't much of an explanation put forth on what went wrong, and there was a period of time that had passed. And it was, in fact, older technology being used. And, you know, the judge didn't have a neck to strangle, so he just basically dropped a bomb. The reality is with technologies, you can always sample your results at the end and gain comfort. You don't have to rely on black boxes. You should be looking at results and getting comfortable with what the tools are telling you. And I was hoping in your top 10 list you'd put the podcast, the ESI podcast I did in December with Judge Grimm and Judge Facciola on search and retrieval and setting up some type of a cloud that it's okay to be using some of the analytics and concepts and predictive, because the judges are in some instances just really interested in writing an opinion in this area to try to keep pushing the field forward. But anyway, you're right. You know, different jurisdictions are going to react different ways. So. You should always...
And individual judges are going to react different ways. So yeah. As much as there's been a quest for uniformity under Rule 502, I don't know if the rule's done what Congress intended it to do.
Yep.
So, but that's another question. I think one part of the rule, for example, Rule 502D, which is the non-waiver rule of provision, is really underused. And I don't know why. When I go and speak to groups of attorneys, particularly people who may not spend a lot of time in federal court, and I ask them about 502, who knows about it, 9 out of 10 hands don't go up. So there's something going on. I don't know what it is, but it's pretty fascinating, and I can't understand why in litigation, especially if you have large volumes of information, parties wouldn't want to enter into a non-waiver order. But
it's
that's
just to get out of jail pass to some extent if you enter into the agreement with both sides. I mean, it gives you more protection. I don't see the downside in using it. And that's our next case deals with Rule 502. And, you know, I, too, was hoping we'd see more cases in this because I did this podcast, ESI Bites podcast with Tom Allman and Judge Grimm. And I think I read 3 law review articles that Tom sent me on Rule 502, which was painful.
You know, there are a lot of law review articles on it, but there's not much There's not much in the area on other than 502B, and then we're going to talk about Rojava, which is 502D, which is what we kind of segued into.
Yeah, so let's talk about Rojava versus McGuire Woods, LLP number 08-2638, District of Kansas, July 22nd, 2010.
Well, Rojava was interesting because one party in Rojava resisted a 502D order. And this is a decision written by someone we know very well, Judge Waxy, sitting in Kansas City, Kansas. And he said, you know, there's no reason why a 502D order can't be entered over the objections of one party. Those of you listening, if you're not familiar with 502D, which is entirely likely, the concept of Rule 502D is that Carl and I, for example, can enter into an agreement where if we exchange information, if we inadvertently turn something over, it's not deemed a waiver. That agreement, once reduced to an order, is binding on us and on everyone else in the world. So if we're litigating in, for example, the Western District of Pennsylvania, and someone sues Carl's client in the District of New Jersey, a New Jersey judge, a federal judge, is going to look at a 502D order and say there's no waiver here. So it's a powerful tool. Rojava was the first decision I know where the question of a 502D order came up in an adversarial context. But just because it seems there aren't that many 502D orders being asked for or granted, I just wonder how much jurisprudence we're going to see in the area.
Yep. So, well, the next case is moving out of the U.S. Case law area. This is well, it's U.S. case law, but we're talking about international cases. And it's NRA Payment Card Interchange Fee and Merchant Discount Antitrust Litigation, 2010, Westlaw 3420517, out of the Eastern District of New York, August 27th. 2010, and it gives us some insights on the transnational e-discovery issues. What's your reaction or your insights into that case?
Well, there's a collision between concepts of litigation in the United States and every place else in the world. We believe in expansive discovery, and it's party-driven. And in a lot of other countries, number one, it's not party-driven. It's really driven through the judiciary, because the judiciary presides over discovery in some countries. And number two, there are a lot of privacy ramifications in other countries that the United States doesn't have. So sometimes you're in a situation where a party in, for example, England is asked to produce information, and they can't do it because of the European Privacy Directive as enacted in that country. What credit card exchange really talks about is not e-discovery per se. It just says, you know, there was information provided by some entities involved in antitrust litigation in the United States. There was a combine or antitrust investigation in Europe. These American entities produced information for the Europeans. The information is confidential under European law. And judge in the United States, don't make us turn this over to the other side. And the court in this case went through an analysis under the Aerospatiale decision from the United States Supreme Court, decided in the 1980s, looked at the interests of everyone in getting information and said, you know what, I'm not gonna make you turn this over. It's confidential under European law. I think we're going to be seeing, as economies keep growing, as more and more countries enact privacy legislation, and there's discussion about privacy legislation now going on in Asia and the Pacific. There are proposals to change the European Privacy Directive. We're probably going to see more collisions between U.S. litigants who may have information overseas and getting that information back to the United States.
Okay.
And this is in here just to say, you know, there are circumstances where information exists in another country where a court is not going to be requiring production because it would run afoul of some rules in the other country.
You know, as we're sitting in a time when we're throwing out the red carpet for the Chinese Premier Hu and trying to create more trade, I mean, it's truly, you know, these global issues are going to keep growing, no doubt about it. And it's not always going to be our jurisdictions anyway that are controlling. You know, lots of political issues here. So,
absolutely. And I think it's fair to say that it's going to become increasingly politicized in the next few years. But we'll see what happens. You know, hope springs eternal, or something like that.
That's true. You know, of course, this next case illustrates that cases are not in order, because this is one of the cases or sets of cases that I think generated the most discussion in 2010. And so let's talk about sanctions and the big cases in 2010. I mean, obviously, you had Pension Committee. You know, I won't read the sites on these because these cases are also known. Rimkus Consulting Group came out. Victor Stanley V. Creative Pipe came out. You've got Southern New England Telephone and Global Naps, Robert Ted Flavors v. Triform Construction. Let's talk about sanctions in general.
Well, there's so much here to talk about. Let's start with the first decision of 2010 on point, and that's Pension Committee by Judge Shinlin in the Southern District of New York. That is an outgrowth of the Zubilek decisions that Judge Shinlin decided 7 years earlier. And looking at the law in the Second Circuit, Judge Shinlin said, you know, there are standards of state of mind that are relevant to whether or not you fail to preserve things and there should be spoliation sanctions imposed on you. And she created standards based on gross negligence, on negligence, and on willfulness. And as we talk through this, the question of state of mind, which is what I'll call it, is one of what I say is a trilogy of things to consider in sanctions. One is state of mind. The other is relevance of the information lost. And the third is prejudice. So Pension Committee is 80 or 90 pages long, and it looks at the failure of a number of plaintiffs in litigation to preserve certain types of information. And Judge Shinlin goes through different failures and says, you know what, if you don't have a written litigation hold, that's gross negligence. If you haven't done this, it's negligence. She goes through all that. And the reason Pension Committee is so important is because I think it's on one side of a spectrum of state of mind. Now, if you look at the Camerata decision, which is another one that's cited, Camerata is decided by Lee Rosenthal, very influential jurist, sitting in Houston, Texas. A party there had failed to preserve information, and she said, you know what, in Texas, in the Fifth Circuit, the standard is willfulness. So you, party seeking spoliation sanctions, have to show that the other side intentionally did something or failed to do something. That's on the other side of what I'll call the spectrum. Then you have Judge Grimm comes along, decides Victor Stanley 2. Victor Stanley 1 was about privilege issues and waiver issues. In Victor Stanley 2, Judge Grimm canvasses the law of the country. He has an excellent chart attached to the opinion that looks circuit by circuit to spoliation standards and says at the end of the day, because the defendant there pretty obviously had done things intentionally, I can impose sanctions here, I can recommend sanctions, but by the way, we really should have some type of uniformity across the country, which goes back to the first point I made about Duke, where one of the things that came out of the Duke conference was the need for some type of uniformity. Incidentally, Judge Grimm in Victor Stanley 2 recommended that the principal of the defendant, if certain sanctions were not paid, be imprisoned for a period of time through the exercise of the contempt power. That went up to a district judge, and that was not adopted by the district judge. District judge basically saying, let's wait and see what happens. As a general proposition, magistrate judges can't impose any type of contempt sanctions. They make recommendations to the DJ. going to the trilogy that I was talking about, we have the SNET case from the Second Circuit where the exercise of a court's contempt power was upheld. And one of the things the Court of Appeals said is, you know, this is a contempt. Prejudice is not important. The issue here really is compliance with an order or not, and we're going to focus on that. So my idea of the trilogy kind of disappears when you're exercising the contempt power. And then last, we have the decision by Magistrate Judge Francis from the Southern District of New York, who's written a lot on e-discovery over the years, where in his Orbit One decision, he's questioning some of the things Judge Shindlin concluded, for example, the need to have written hold notices all the time, and setting up a little discussion, I think, within the Southern District of New York, as opposed to everywhere else, as to exactly what parties need to do to preserve and what the sanction going to be, if any, after electronic information has been lost.
Yeah, it was funny. We did the judicial training that we've talked a little bit about on predictive coding and concept searching, and I had Judge Francis and Judge Shindlin involved in this, and everyone asked, did you ask them about the conflict? And I said, heck no.
Yeah.
We were talking about technology, and that's all we talked about. But it is interesting, and I think it just shows that the whole area is an iterative evolution as we think through things and try to make sense of what the best way to approach cases are. So,
well, remember also that there's really not that much circuit guidance on point. I have the Robertet decision in here from the New Jersey Supreme Court because here's the court of last resort in my jurisdiction saying, you know, there's a sliding scale. We look at all these factors together. And the court really didn't talk about state of mind as being the central factor. But we've got 50 states looking at things possibly different ways. Those states may or may not have even addressed the issue. We've got the circuits going different ways. For example, the Fifth Circuit is a standard, has a willfulness standard. The Eighth Circuit has a willfulness standard. We see a lot of variation around the country. So that's one argument in favor of some type of uniformity. Especially if you are representing some type of multi-state organization or corporation where it may be hauled into court in different states. A number of people I've spoken to by default say, you know what, the strictest standard is Judge Shindlin's. We do business across the country. We can't afford, if that's the word you want to use, to take a narrower construction of Scienter, and we're going to go as far as we can to save things. Now, whether that's right or not is a question for another day.
Yeah, we did a show with Mike Lackey and Mayor Brown on Rehnquist versus Pension Committee and focused on this split issue. And I do recall he agreed that if there was a case that could be taken to the Supreme Court to decide this, that they would do it pro bono, he thought, at Mayor Brown. So.
Well,
such an important issue. I think you know, anyone that's close to this field would love to see this decided.
I would just be very surprised that the Supreme Court ever took it, but you never know.
Yep. Okay. So, well, the next case let's talk about the Supreme Court, because the next case you suggested in 2009's recap show was being held by the Supreme Court and would bear watching for 2010, and that's the Supreme Court stab at electronic privacy issues and City of Ontario versus Kwan, and there are a couple of other cases I think you were going to talk about as well. Stengart v. Loving Care Agency, 2010, Westlaw 1189458, New Jersey Superior Court, March 30, 2010. And then there's a case that I guess came down yesterday in the Supreme Court that I don't have the site in front of me that you were going to mention as well. So let's talk about electronic privacy issues.
Well, let's start with Kwan. Sergeant Kwan is an officer in the city of Ontario in California. He's a member of the SWAT team. He's given access to a pager, and he can send text messages. And for one reason or another, eventually his supervisors found some, inappropriate text messages, and he was disciplined. And the question became in the Supreme Court whether or not the city can go and look at his text messages. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, this is an employer-employee relationship. Granted, it's the government involved, but the sergeant's due process rights are a lot different than they might be and might be in a criminal field or whatever. And the city acted reasonably in its investigation, and he was disciplined, and that ended that. Yesterday, the Supreme Court decided NASA versus Nelson, and I'll give you the citation to it. I'll give you the Supreme Court cite to it in a minute. And it's NASA versus Nelson. It's number 09530, came out of the Ninth Circuit. It involves NASA. NASA runs the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It contracts that work out basically to a university in California. So California university employees are effectively working for NASA. And the question becomes whether or not certain questions can be asked of these employees by NASA to determine whether, for example, they're involved in drug use and the like. The employee said, oh, no, this is an invasion of my unwarranted invasion of my privacy rights. Ninth Circuit agrees, goes up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, reverses, goes back kind of to Kwan, although interestingly it doesn't cite Kwan, and says, you know, this is the government as a proprietor or employer. The government can do things to look into the background of employees. And the Supreme Court said, for our purposes, we're going to treat these university employees as government employees. It's reasonable to ask questions of drug use and the like for any one of a number of reasons. And by the way, when the information is turned over, the Privacy Act protects this information from just being disclosed to the world. So I think if you put Kwan and you put NASA together, even though NASA doesn't involve ESI, electronically stored information, this Supreme Court is probably going to be taking the position, you know what, we can assume that there are certain rights and the like, and at least in the employer-employee employment context, we're going to look to the question of whether whatever the government does is reasonable and whether its steps are reasonable. And NASA goes a little further because it says, you know what, the information can't become public because of the Privacy Act. We're not going to deal with hypothetical concerns about how information might become public or not. Interestingly, there was the concurring opinion is by Scalia, joined in with Thomas, and says, you know, there's no such thing as a right of privacy under the Constitution. Disagrees with the Whalen decision from the Supreme Court years ago, and the majority opinion written by Justice Alito assumes the existence of that right and then says, you know what was done here was reasonable and it's sufficient. So even though that's going to go in my 2011 top list, I need to talk about it now because I think if you look at Kwan and NASA together, they say something about the Supreme Court.
That's all right.
In the area of privacy.
We have a top 10 list with 12 things on it. So the December 31st Infernal Yearbook, a look back review is also just a number we can ignore.
It's a point
in time that we do the podcast with you looking back. Okay, we have flexible rules with you, Ron. So.
Well, and then the last decision I have in here is Stengart. Stengart, again, comes out of my jurisdiction in New Jersey Supreme Court. The plaintiff in Stengart winds up in employment litigation with her employer. She had communicated with her attorney over the employer's systems, but she went to an encrypted email provider, by the way. The question became whether there was a waiver of privilege, and the New Jersey Supreme Court said, you know what, there's no waiver of privilege. She took steps to encrypt her communications or the like. There's been no waiver, and by the way, we are going to declare as a matter of policy in New Jersey that communications like this are going to be protected. It doesn't mean anything in the larger sense other than the way one state goes, but there are always decisions, Carl, coming out where employees use employer systems to communicate with third persons, including lawyers. And I think it's fair to say most of the case law says, you know, number one, if you communicate over an employer system without any type of encryption or protections, you kind of waive any privilege you had. And then number two, depending on the nature of the communications and the like, a court may or may not recognize as a matter of public policy some type of protection. This is the states. I don't think you're ever going to see the feds going that way up at the Supreme Court level, but, you know, who knows. And it's an interesting area. All these decisions put together really talk about rights of employees and employers, and other than NASA, talk about rights when you're communicating using electronic systems.
Yep. Well, the next case we've been waiting on for a while to wind up and provide us with guidance on how attorneys and clients interact in e-discovery, and it's the poster child for project management. It's Qualcomm Inc. v. Broadcom Corp. 2010 Westlaw 133-6937 Southern District, California, April 2nd, 2010. So what are your what's your final conclusions on Qualcomm now?
My final conclusions on Qualcomm is that there's nothing satisfactory that's come out of that decision from anyone's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow the continuing saga of Qualcomm, really what's going on here is that attorneys are saying they asked questions of a client for information and the information was withheld, and the client's saying, no, we gave it to you probably 2 years ago now. There was a decision from the district court that said, you know what, client, when you're making allegations against your attorney, the attorney can't respond because of privilege. The privilege is deemed waived, and that led to an enormous amount of discovery before this went back before a magistrate judge for a final decision. And by the time that happened, I think it's fair to say careers had either been ruined or impaired. And at the end of the day, it was kind of a wash, I guess, and the court just ended it. But it's just a salutary example of attorney-client communications or miscommunications or lack of communications and how it can be amplified when you're dealing with electronic information where you've got it in employer systems and the attorney is trying to get information from the client about where everything is and what it consists of. So as I said, I think at the end of the day, it was unsatisfactory all around.
Yeah, and every time I look at this, I remember I've got a final draft of a chapter on project management, an update of a chapter in a book I wrote that I've got to finish. You know, this case is really about documentation to some extent and, you know, not getting in at the end of a case and trying to figure out what happened, have sort of a record of what happened. So that, you know, you can figure it out better at the end instead of he said, she said type of a scenario. But it's unfortunate when attorneys and clients end up fighting at the end. This is sort of an oddball case, but anyway.
Well, it's an oddball case, but it's been a poster child of competence and ethics issues now since, I guess, 2007.
Yep.
When the first opinion came out.
Front page news story.
And it's over. I mean, I believe at the end of the day, there was some type of settlement involving the parties of something. I saw a little report in the Wall Street Journal and never followed it. Settlement not about the litigation per se, but resolving a number of global issues as far as I could tell. We have the magistrate judge's decision here from last April ending the sanctions saga for the attorneys, and there we are.
Okay, well, we're on our final case here, and it deals with public records, O'Neill v. City of Shoreline, 2010, Westlaw 391-1347, Washington Superior Court, October 7, 2010. What's important about City of Shoreline?
What's important about the City of Shoreline for electronic records is the question of what is a record under state law and what some government agency might be required to do to see whether records are being turned over consistent with a request by the citizen. We have here an instance where information was sought, email communications were sought, and the question was whether you could get email communications from a public official, from personal systems, and the Washington Supreme Court said, you know what, this is what our statute says. Records can well qualify for this information, and therefore we're going to require you to go back and look for it. So I guess it's another cautionary tale about being careful what type of information you look for, where it is, and how you as an entity manage to control what individuals may have that somehow constitutes a record, whether it's a corporate record or a public record or the like. Now, yesterday or the day before, there was a Pennsylvania appellate court that came out. Different facts, but this is a question of whether or not a municipality is required to go to a public official and get information off the public official's personal computer to turn it over. The appellate court there said under Pennsylvania law, no, you don't need to do that, although the public agency has to take some steps to say there's no subterfuge involved and the like. Again, though, this is a big issue because just the scope of electronic information, how people communicate one way or the other, and what might be on whose system.
Yep, lots of issues there, Ron, and those issues continue to grow with all the devices we have around us. So great lists, and now that you completely are trampling all over the December 31st deadline, we'll end this show.
Why did you trample over? You notice I didn't give you the citation to the case. I just said there's something out there. So anyone interesting can take a look.
No, it's all good stuff. I trample away. It's we're talking about trends here, not dates, really. So, but I want to thank you again for joining us on another show, Ron. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully and probably we'll do more shows with you later this year. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.